Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. Here with me today is Hal Hirschfield. Hal is an assistant professor of marketing at the Anderson School of Management at UCLA. He's a fascinating guy. He's done some super interesting research about who we are today, who we want to become, and how we bridge that gap, and why it's hard even to bridge that gap. So I'm super excited to speak with him and to have him at the Bregman Leadership Podcast. Hal, thank you so much for joining us on the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter. I appreciate it.
So, Hal, share with us, if you would, the focus of your research, because I just, you know, give us an overview and then we'll jump in.
Sure thing. A lot of my work really looks at how we can understand and help people get from who they are today to where they want to be, and why it's so hard for them to as you said, bridge that gap. So we often see people say that they want to do things. They say they want to eat healthy. They say they want to save more money. They say they want to be more environmentally friendly. And yet, when push comes to shove, it's really hard to actually take that leap and do those sorts of things.
Now, this might seem like a stupid question, but why? Why is it hard? You would think that you would do the thing that's in your own right. best interest, that you know and you're clear is in your
right.
own best interest.
No, and it's not a stupid question. And it's a question that's been puzzling scholars and theorists and academics for decades, if not centuries. And, you know, I think if you were to really boil it down, the reason that it's so hard to do these things is because the present is so powerful. So there's a great quote from a colleague of mine, Liz Dunn, and she said that the present acts as a magnifying glass for our emotions. And I thought that just really hit the nail on the head, which is that, you know, if we were to step back and look at our lives from sort of a high up vantage point, it'd be easy to see how, you know, it'd be better to go to the gym that day, and that day. But when I'm in it, here I am today, it's a lot easier to sleep in. It's a lot easier to eat that, you know, higher calorie, richer food lunch than it is to take the salad or get up at 5 and go to the gym, etc. All these things represent that tension between doing something we want to do right now versus what we know we should do for the long run.
And, you know, I've written about this a little bit, and I know you have, and I've thought a lot about the environment, yeah. right? Which is to create an environment that makes it more likely that you're going to do the things that you want to do versus not. What role does that play in it? Or are we relying on something that is ultimately in some ways ephemeral, and that, in fact, we should be developing a kind of a stronger internal sense of our future?
No, I think it plays a huge role. You know, this is why your point about the environment is why interventions that rely on just changing default settings and default options are often so effective. So we know one of the most effective ways to get people to save for retirement is to essentially make it automatic. You're automatically enrolled in a retirement plan. You don't have to make that decision right now.
Right. It's the Thaler nudge.
Exactly. And so there's a lot of those that we see. You know, we can, of course, set up the cafeteria so that the salad and the carrots and the celery are up front and the pizza and the junk food is in the back corner or something like that. Right. But, you know, at a certain point, it can't just be the environment that we have to change. We also have to think about changing our willingness to step forward and get to the table and make these changes ourselves and make these decisions ourselves.
So you've done this great research I would love for you to describe around the brain and strangers sure. and you know, your future self. Could you describe it a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the angles that my research has taken is that people have a hard time making these decisions because they fundamentally feel some sort of emotional disconnect between their current selves and their future selves. And the analogy that we've liked to use and others have used as well is that the future self almost seems as if it's a stranger, another person altogether. And so in some early research, we started with the previous finding that the brain is actually really good at figuring out what's me and what's not me. There's some distinction in the brain. When we see another face or we think about another person, we see one neural signature versus when we think about ourselves, we see another one. And what we reasoned was if the future self is thought of as another person, we might see that those same brain differences when people think about, see, write about, etc., their future selves. And that's exactly what we found. In the brain, it looks like, across the board, the future self seems more like another person than it seems like ourselves. Now, I really should be clear here. That's true in general. But of course, there's individual differences, right? There's some people who see the future self as very much the same or an extension or similar to who they are now. And then you don't see those differences as much.
And then I imagine those people you might find stick to their diets or save more money or things like that. Did you find that in your research?
That's the thinking. I mean, we haven't looked specifically at dieting, but we've looked at other tasks that rely on patience. And what it seems like is that when people are able to see that emotional connection between their current selves and their future selves, they're the ones who are more patient. They're the ones who have accrued more assets over time. Even when you control for other factors that might play a role there.
You know, it just occurred to me this would be fascinating. I don't know if you'd be interested or are able to do it. But if you think about those marshmallow experiment participants, right? The six-year-olds back in the 70s.
Yeah.
It would be fascinating to say, for the listeners, the marshmallow experiments were I'm trying to remember his last name. It was Michel was his first name.
Walter Michel.
Michel was his last name. Walter Michel, and he took kids, you know, 5, 6 year olds, I think, mm-hmm. and he gave them a marshmallow and he put them in a room and he said, "You could eat this marshmallow now, but if you wait, I think it was around 20 minutes, and you don't eat it, I'll give you 2 marshmallows.
Right, right.
And there were certain kids who, and it's delightful if you look at these videos of like how the kids managed to hold themselves off. Some kids ate them right away. Some kids managed to hold off. And I wonder whether if you researched, you know, if you looked at the brains of the kids and, you know, now adults who were able to hold off even those 20 minutes, whether they would have a stronger sense of their future selves as themselves versus a stranger.
That's a great question. It's a really great question. And, I don't know the answer to that, but you would imagine that, well, maybe they would. It could be sort of a general characteristic that plays in even that young. I don't know the answer, though. It's a fascinating topic, though, because it takes a long time for the neural structures to develop that can help kids and adolescents even think about the future beyond a certain period of time, right?
Right, right. So that would be that. Yeah, that's interesting.
But it's a really interesting question. Those kids who waited, you know, they end up having higher SAT scores later and all sorts of positive outcomes.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Like they've been able to achieve their goals in ways that the kids that didn't wait were less able to do.
Right.
And I wonder if that's really correlated with a sense of, you know, even at that young age, I actually have some sense of, you know, 20 minutes from now.
Right, like, right, right.
We're looking at 20 years from now.
Exactly.
But maybe for those kids, 20 minutes from now.
It's a great question. And of course, this ability to generally be able to step into the shoes of a future self, whether it's a 20-minute self or 10-year self, can really help when it comes to delaying gratification, can really help when it comes to being patient with these long-term tasks, where overall, you might be better off if you wait. But of course, in the moment, there's some tension there.
Yeah, I've often talk about buffets as being a challenge for me, and this idea that what I want to eat in the moment is different than what I want to have eaten by the end of the meal. And so, you know, if I could just, I was with a friend of mine who was reminding me of that as he was eating. And he says he keeps asking himself that question when he wants to eat something. What do I want to have eaten as opposed to what do I want to eat? And that shift of saying, what do I want to have eaten, you know, is a, that's a future self shift.
I think that's a really great idea, you know, because I think oftentimes what happens is people say, be going in, what do I want to eat? And they stop there. And then they get to the buffet and they say, well, you know, screw what I wanted to eat. How about what I want to eat right now? But you're right. They don't take that sort of it's a little confusing, but that it's almost like a future retrospective perspective of saying, right, what will it be like to be, you know, on the next day and look back on what I just did, or even later this afternoon.
Right. What have you found? Because you know, and I find actually this is sort of interesting with academics and research now, as opposed to even 10 years ago,
yeah,
is that as academics, you and others are looking at really practical applications of, yeah, the research and solutions, yeah, for the challenges that we're facing, that you're not just researching for research's sake, but you're trying to solve problems. What have you found has helped people to bridge that gap between their current self and their future self?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. You know, we found a couple things seem to work, and they range from the very low tech to you know, more cutting edge technology, I would say. And so one that seems to work is to have people sit down and write a letter to their future selves. Now, this, of course, is not a quick and dirty intervention, right? This is not something that we can just, you know, put up a billboard for and have everybody change their behavior. But, you know, this would be the type of thing you would want to implement in the right situation, where you have some time and you have context where someone can actually take the space to write this sort of letter. We've also done tasks where we've use technology to show people an age progressed image of themselves. And it's, you know, to me, it's really like a heuristic to get people to think forward in time, to actually see that distant self in a way that they might not otherwise have considered.
So I'm so curious about that. I wanted to ask you about that,
yeah,
because I read that in the research and I actually did it. I went on, I can't remember the app, but I bought an app.
Yeah.
And it was right now sits next to my zombie app, which zombifies me, right? It makes me a zombie if you take a picture of yourself.
And but this one, old enough into the future, they're not that different.
They're not that different. It's scary. Exactly. But I looked at myself and I thought, I'd be a little hard pressed, yep, to have like this convince me to stick to my diet or save more. It kind of bummed me out a little bit about, yep, what I would look like at that age, but it didn't motivate me. But I think you found a difference.
Right. Now, I think what you're getting at though really highlights the need for the appreciation of nuance in these sort of interventions. You know, I think when I did that research with my colleagues, we had a controlled setting. The participants were within a narrow age range, 20 or 18 to 35 or so. And we had taken our time with aging people's faces. We actually hired a graphic artist to help us. That's different than some of these apps that you can download, which I think can be good, but if you go too far into the future or your photo's not quite right, I suspect, and I don't have the data on this, but I suspect that it could have a backfire effect. Where
it just also occurred to me, yeah, and I'm sort of a little embarrassed or sad to say this, but I may be of the age where I am now my future self.
Listen, don't be embarrassed. When I started this research, I was much younger, and each year that goes by, I look at these pictures that I created of my future self 10 years ago, and I think, oh my God, I look more and more like that than I do my past self.
Yeah, like this may not be a problem for me anymore because I'm already just living my future self.
And I know we're joking, but I think that to some extent, some of these interventions are more useful for a younger audience who really doesn't spend the time thinking about their future selves and could really benefit from doing so. Now, I'm guessing, you know, someone who's in their 40s, the idea of retirement isn't so foreign. Yeah, it could be 20 years down the line, but at some point you have to start thinking about it. But if you're 22 and you just graduated, I think some of the thinking is, why should I put any money away now? I'd rather use this for going to bars on the weekend. And that's when it really could matter to say,
that's
there will be a future self of yours down
right,
the line.
Right, right. You know, and I think it's actually interesting because I bet cultural messages make a huge difference. I mean, I grew up not only with a sense of the importance of saving and the importance of putting away and the importance of legacy and, you know, as a kid, but also I'm Jewish and there was this, you know, my parents, my mother was in the Holocaust in France, and there was this sense of like why we're here, why we exist, and it's not for us as much. I mean, it's for us also, but it's also for what we can create in future generations. So I imagine the cultural messages that we hear over and over again impacts how we see our future selves.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And that is, you know, that's the idea of sort of group level future oriented thinking is a really interesting question to me. Something I haven't really explored much, but considering that there's some cultures who are closer knit and really see not just the future, like what you're saying, but also, I mean, to take the example of a more secular Jewish culture, the idea of a long past that we can see playing into the present and projecting forward into the future, I think, you know, that becomes a really interesting question when I'm not just saving for me, but also for future generations.
It's fascinating. I was just thinking as you were saying this, the link between ancestors and progeny, right?
Yes.
The sense of if I can really see clearly into my past, that probably reinforces the way that I think clearly into my future.
That's exactly right. And in fact, I mean, I don't want to be too self-promotional, but I actually have a paper about this idea of mirroring the past into the future for environmental decision making. And we don't need to get into it, but it's the idea was actually taken from an astrophysicist who said, basically, if we want to try to figure out how long a star is going to live for, we should just figure out how long it's already been in existence and just mirror that into the future. And the idea is that we, as a general rule, as a heuristic, we see how long something's been around and we think, let's just project that forward. And that can really matter when it comes to making these long-term decisions that will have effects and consequences long after our lifetimes.
You know, it feels really important, and it's important for leaders also, in my sense, because so often we come in wanting to change things.
Yeah.
And what it suggests is leverage to change things in the future can be built on the foundation of what existed in the past. And so often we try to distance ourselves from the past in order to create a new future. But what you're saying, which is super profound, is that, you know, actually it's the opposite. It's by having a deep respect for the past that we can actually envision a future that can move us forward.
I think that's exactly right. And from an organizational standpoint, that doesn't mean, oh, you have to just build in a sort of marginal way on the past because we need to respect it. I think you can have major changes to organizational culture or thinking or leadership while still at the same time preserving some sort of values or core identity that your group has built up over time. And I think that's exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, that's great. It's powerful. So I actually, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you and that motivated this conversation is actually an idea I got from your research that I wanted to explore with you. And it's actually comes out of the sort of a spiritual idea that that you see in every spiritual tradition that basically says we are all one, right? That ultimately we're all connected and we're all one. And I found it fascinating that I might actually see my future self in the same way that I see a stranger.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether flipped on its head, it actually is the same message. And I wonder whether the solution isn't to create a deeper connection to our future selves as much as it is to create a deeper connection to the people around us and to really see them and us as not that different, so that rather than close the gap between myself and myself, if I close the gap between myself and the other, then I will care for my future self. And there was something really beautiful about this idea, and I wanted to explore it.
I love it. And I think that, you know, this is in fact something that my, you know, closest collaborators and I have been talking in these themes for a while now, and we've never actually gotten down to do it. But the idea that essentially what a lot of this boils down to is our ability to step into other minds. So we've been talking about this in terms of stepping into the mind of my future self, but it's really theoretically should operate on the same principles as stepping into the minds of other people and taking their perspective, and not just taking their perspective, but empathizing with them and seeing what their worldview is like, what their situations are like, and how their context can affect their thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. In the same way, we want to do something similar with our future selves. But I agree with you that there can be other mechanisms for solving these problems. And also, to flip that on its head, other problems can be solved at the same time. Right?
Right.
And I think, you know, because, it, you know, if we're only taking care of our future selves, we may be neglecting others. And in fact, one of my collaborators, Dan Bartels, has a fascinating paper where he finds that people who are better connected to their future selves actually, you know, this is in a laboratory context, donate less to other people because they're choosing to donate it to their future selves. Whereas those who see no real connection to their future selves, if given the option to give money to others right now or money to their future selves, they choose to give money to others. And so this is sort of the dark side of this, you know, like you said, we could close the gap between ourselves and ourselves, or we could try to close the gap between ourselves and others. Obviously, the better thing to do, like you said, would be to create more of a sort of oneness or togetherness or however you want to term it, and have connection to others and to ourselves in the future as well.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. I can see how it would operate both ways, and it would be interesting to think about how to do it in a way that creates not only personal good but social good.
Right, exactly.
And that Dan Bartels' research is very interesting because it would suggest that the closer we see ourselves in the future, the less we feel connected to the other people.
Now I'm not sure if that's necessarily the case, but it all depends on whether we see this as a zero-sum game or a pie that we can expand. You know, it seems right to me that we could actually really expand the pie for our future selves if we figure out how to make these connections to others stronger right now for a variety of reasons.
You know, I guess it would be interesting because if the research that you've done so far is creating more of a connection between yourself and your future self, and that has increased your own savings and decreased your giving, I wonder if you've looked at doing research which really helps you connect to other people.
Right.
It's kind of the reverse side.
Right.
And see whether that by definition ends up helping you to support yourself also. I don't know.
It's a great question. We haven't done it, but it would seem like if some of the principles that this operates on is being able to take other people's perspectives and our future self as another, then these interventions should help out for that intrapersonal connection as well.
Yeah, it's super.
It's really cool. Yeah.
You asked 1,000 people who is their worst enemy.
Yeah.
And half of them said
themselves.
Themselves. So this is that idea, right? My worst enemy. I look at that buffet, or I look at, you know, I spend my money on beer, and I don't put it in my IRA or the, you know, 401k.
Exactly, and it, you know, I think no. Of course, I should note that I gave people. I said, you know, it was a forced choice question where one of the options was themselves. I might not have found such a high percentage if I left it open-ended, but I do think it probably, whatever the exact number is, I think it reflects a sophisticated realization on behalf of many people, which is that they know that they are often the cause of their own misery, right? And this is, right, you know, this is why we have so many of these business ideas and products and contracts that allow us to really protect ourselves from ourselves, right?
Right, right. That's the environment piece.
Exactly. It's the environment piece, yes.
It feels like there's something important here about the heat of the moment. And I wonder whether you've done, you know, I know Dan Ariely's done some super interesting research about, you know, like choices I would make when I'm saying I would make these choices. And then in the heat of the moment, what choice do I make?
Yes.
And that it's often the opposite of what I said I would, exactly. which is similar. So have you looked at like maybe when you should look at that, you know, like carry that picture around of your future self and look at it, you know, take a deep breath right before you go to the buffet or right before you're making that decision and look at, have you looked at that at all?
We haven't. And I think I would love to, because I think that, you know, what we've primarily focused on are these one shot decisions. So signing up for your 401k, that's the type of choice you make once or, you know, or however many times you start a new job. Right. But it's not the type of thing that confronts us in a daily setting. Whereas in the dieting or healthy living domain, we are regularly faced with these temptations, right? And so I question whether or not pulling out a picture of my future self would really be effective in those settings, because after a while we would habituate to it just like we would anything else. And so, I mean, now that maybe is a problem for a smart choice architect to solve, someone to think about, well, how do I get this to be presented in a way that's maybe novel and emotionally evocative every time? That's something I haven't solved.
I remember that my mother once had a bought this very funny, it was a pig, and you put it in the refrigerator and it's activated by light. So when you open the refrigerator, the light goes on, it goes, and you look at it and you go, huh, I don't really know that I want to go for what I was going for. And you did habituate, you know, you kind of laughed it off and habituated to it after a while. So that might, you know, that might be what happened.
That's great. After a little while, you just associate, now you have a new association where that noise signals it's time to eat.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Time to go to the trough. You are a psychologist,
yeah,
and you're also an assistant professor of marketing.
Right.
And I'm curious about, and you work at a business school, and I'm curious about how the research gets used. So yeah. I spend most of my time around human behavior and leadership, and I, you know, in what way are marketers, or in what way are you teaching this in the context of marketing?
No, that's a great question. You know, I would say that the majority of my research focuses on consumer level behavior rather than firm level behavior. And so what I try to look at is ways that we can help consumers do the things that they say that they want to do. Now, there are business opportunities in that. So whenever I do consulting, I love the opportunities that allow for benefits to be accrued to firms and consumers at the same time. So companies that can help people start saving more, that benefits the company, but it benefits people too, or companies that are trying to help people eat healthier, et cetera. So when we think about how this can be applied, of course, probably like any social psychological insight, there are insights.
There's a dark side.
There's the dark side, and there's
the bright side.
Right. And so, you know, I have seen this research being used by financial firms that try to get people to save more. I've seen it being used by some public service announcements to get people to be healthier when it comes to their alcohol consumption. On the other hand, I used to live in New York, and right before I left New York, the New York Lotto implemented a campaign that said, do your future self a favor and buy a lottery ticket, which was, you know, I can go on record and say that's not what we intended.
So, you know, part of what I'm thinking this research does by having more people understand it is it helps protect you from that. Meaning you can look at that and go, ah, now I see what they're doing. Yep. They're kind of using this future self thing in a way that's probably not in my best interest.
Yeah, that's
right. I'm not going to fall for it. But in this case over here, it is in my best interest and I will fall for it on purpose.
That's right. And I, you know, we don't know how effective these interventions are when people are sort of aware of what's going on versus sort of passive, you know, participants in whatever the context is. But I think you're right. You know, just like any other research, people can be consumers of the research findings and try to recognize when these findings are being implemented in the real world and see how they respond to it.
Hal, next steps for your research, what are you looking at now?
Yeah, well, right now we're doing a variety of projects, some of which are much more basic science oriented, trying to understand where the origin of this tendency to think about the future self as another person comes from. So what we're thinking is that it might stem from our tendency with memories to jump backwards in time rather than to sort of replay things on a timeline. And so I think we do the same thing with our futures. We jump forward in time rather than see how everything is connected between here and 10 years from now. And it's sort of like driving across country. If we drive from New York to Pittsburgh, we see how the neighborhoods change and the landscape changes and everything. But if we fly there, we don't see any of those connections. And so what we're trying to figure out is, why is it that we don't feel that sense of connection to our future selves? And I think it stems from how we just visualize it in time. We've also been looking at other domains. So we're doing a big study now on weight loss and seeing if we can help people lose weight by projecting images of their bodies changing over time. That's been going on for a while now. And then we've been looking at this in other contexts as well, looking at older people who have to make decisions about end-of-life choices and things like annuities and wills and whatnot, and seeing what level of connection to future selves or future generations might be helpful for them.
You know, it's interesting too, as I listen to you, I think there's an advantage to not seeing that straight line from you to your future self, which is this tremendous capacity for change. Mm-hmm. And to recognize that there's a certain reality that says, in 10 years, I will actually be a different person. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, I was actually a different person. Again, in the spiritual world, where people talk about, you know, every single cell has changed you over some period of time. I don't know what that period of time is.
Yeah.
But in some ways, there's this deep connection to who we have been, and then in some ways, we have this capacity to be very different than we were in the past.
It's a great point, and one of the things that I'm most fascinated by is how people manage to both change for the better, but at the same time see themselves as some aspect of their core identity being preserved. Mm-hmm. And there's a student at University of Chicago, Sarah Maluki, who's done some really interesting research showing that people incorporate positive change into an idea of similarity. I can be the same over time as long as I'm getting better.
right. That's great. Hal Hirschfield, he is the assistant professor of marketing at UCLA Anderson School of Management. Fascinating research. You can listen to his TED Talk if you look at Hal Hirschfield, TED East. He did a great TED Talk on this subject. And someone to sort of continue to watch and read his research. And I hope we're in many conversations in the future. And thank you so much for being on the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Thanks so much, Peter. I appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.